First of all, I'd like to thank
Bill.
Bridget for asking me. Bridget, almost forgot what I was going to say. Thank Bridget for asking me and Bill for filling in for her tonight. My name is Dan Always, and I'm always an alcoholic. Wasn't it a wonderful day today, weather-wise? Doesn't get any better than this in this county, I don't believe. I love it this time of year. And we went up to Pekin Peak and looked at the leaves and the crafts and ate some food and rode around for a while, and just a lovely day, you know? Lovely day. I'd like to start out by reading the meditation for today out of the 24-hour book for October 22nd. It says, day by day, we should slowly build up an unshakable faith in a higher power and in the power's ability to give us all the help we need. By having these quiet times each morning, we start each day with a renewing of our faith until it becomes almost a part of us and is a strong habit. We should keep furnishing the quiet places of our souls with all the furniture of faith. We should try to fill our thoughts each day with all that is harmonious and good, beautiful, and enduring. As you know, I've just recently come off an operation, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that later. My last name is Pacansky, P-A-C-A-N-S-K-Y. I live on Fairplane Road, which is just across the Fairview Township line going west. If you know where Mason's Farm is, roadside stand is, you're close to where I am. I live down that road. And I grew up on that road. In fact, two houses from where I live now. It's kind of a long story, but that house that I grew up in was one of the original houses on Fairplane Road. It was owned by the Ziesenheim family, and they later on built a newer, bigger house up on the hill. And somehow or other, my grandfather bought some of the property off of Ziesenheim and shared it with my aunt and my dad. So we had 15 acres that my dad planted grapes and tomatoes and all the vegetables you can think of, strawberries and raspberries, and that became our home. And worked hard as a kid, you know. My first job was picking strawberries for 5 cents a quart. So I've come a long way from that. Grew up there in an alcoholic home. Both of my parents drank beer out of the brown bottles, whiskey on special occasions, and they both smoked too. So I grew up with the attitude that there's nothing wrong with that. You know, that's what everybody does. We lived out in the country, so I didn't see a lot of other families and how they lived, you know, until I was, you know, into grade school, probably, you know. So it was something I accepted, you know, and then as you can probably guess, I followed in that trend, you know. In my late teens, I started dabbling a little at weddings and funerals, even whenever there was occasion arose, and did my taste testing, you know. And to be honest with you, I didn't particularly care for beer at first. It just seemed bitter to me, and why would you want to drink it, you know? So I usually switched back to pop for a while, you know. Pepsi was my favorite, and that's what I drank, you know. And coffee in the morning, even before I got out of high school, I'm drinking coffee in the morning every day, you know. That's what we did, that's what they did, that's what I'm doing, you know. Naturally put a lot of sugar and cream in it, you know, when you're younger. So I grew up on that farm and basically didn't spend a lot of time with the school kids and things like that, because there was always work to be done. When I got out of school, I'm lucky if I had a little bit of time to start doing my homework, because My dad would either leave me a note on what he wanted me to get started doing before he got home from work. He worked a full-time job plus the farm. So when he got home, we started getting orders on what we were going to do, you know. And whenever I'd ask for some money, he would say, "Well, you're eating every day, aren't you?" And I said, yeah, we are. So that ended that conversation really fast, you know. And so anyhow, I grew up with the idea that there's nothing wrong with drinking, you know. And the only times I saw problems with my mom and dad was sometimes they'd get into an argument, you know, probably about money or something, you know. Because they both loved each other, I knew that, but they still got into arguments. Whenever they argued, I ran outside. You know, I didn't want to be anywhere near it. I ran away from the conflict. Never liked that idea. And naturally, when I started drinking, I thought I was going to do the same thing they did, be a, I guess you'd call it a responsible drinker, you know, where you would have a couple in the evening just to get relaxed and mellow out and before you went to sleep and then get up the next day and start all over again, you know. But for me, once I got out of high school and avoided the draft, not intentionally, they just didn't take me for whatever reason. My hearing is bad and I knew that. I wore glasses and I was physically sick the day I went in to be drafted, and they just marked me 1Y and I didn't go, you know. So a very short time later, my dad gave me my first job, you know, at the same place where he worked, the Model Works in Girard, and I became a line helper. I hated that job. I didn't like that job. It was too busy. You had to be very fast, very busy. And being a perfectionist as I am, I thought I was going to be able to get everything done every day. And it was impossible, you know. Besides helping furnish parts for everybody on the line, I was supposed to do other stuff too, you know. How am I supposed to do all this stuff? I don't know. Most of the time it didn't get done. I would work through my breaks because I thought I would be sneaky that way and get caught up a little bit. Until the union came around. Somebody from the union came around and said, "You can't do that. You got to take a break just like everybody else does." So I did, and work didn't get done so well. But anyhow, I got laid off from that job in December. And if you didn't know anything about the Model Works, they laid up most of the people off in December for a couple of months at least before they called them back again. And that's the way they work their business, you know. But I transferred to the plastics department and started working as a helper in the plastics department. And they eventually put me on second shift, and I was working second shift, and it was real quiet in there. It was really boring, but I did what I had to do, and even that job only lasted a couple more months, and then I was laid off again. So I took a job with Beaver Paint Company. I don't know if you know where Beaver Paint Company was in Girard. They made paint. You know, how many people make paint anymore? You just go to the store and buy it. You don't make it. But they made paint, and I was the helper again. That's about all I ever knew how to do, was to help people. I couldn't. They didn't allow me to do any thinking, you know, as such. So I was carrying bags of pigment and buckets full of thinner and stuff to put in the mills to make the paint. You know, I had a lot of the labor stuff to do, and I did it willingly. I didn't have any problem with that. You know, I like that kind of work. And plus, I was still working part-time for my dad and my Uncle Pete, who did potatoes in Fairview. I don't know if you knew. Called Joyce's Best was the name of their potatoes that they stamped on the bags, you know. Anyhow, I'm talking too much about that stuff. Let's go to my first falling down drunk was stag party I went to, where they had a keg of beer and raffled off bottles of booze and wine and stuff, and I wholeheartedly got into that. And I helped them sell the bottles, and I started drinking the stuff out of the bottles whenever they would open too, you know. plus drinking the draft beer at the same time. And being an inexperienced drinker as I was, I very quickly got drunk. And that was probably my first blackout or pass out. I'm not sure which one it was or both. But anyhow, I didn't wake up until later that evening on the grass of my dad's house and throwing up and stuff. That's was my first knockdown, drag out, drunk. And for some reason, because I am an alcoholic, I have no control over how much I'm going to drink. I might think I do, you know, and I thought that for many years, you know, that, well, when I have enough, I'll just stop, you know. But I proved that to myself many times toward the end of my drinking that I couldn't do that. I couldn't just slow down, or I couldn't stop completely, you know. Something bad had to happen. Either I would pass out or get sick, and then I'd end up going home and driving drunk a lot of times. I drove drunk a lot. Back before the 1980s, people got away with that. They did. They would tell them, go home, or even drive them home sometimes, the police would, the local police. You know, but in the early 80s, they started changing the laws, and they started arresting people for DUIs, no matter how low their BAC was, you know. And the first time I got arrested, my BAC was pretty low, because I got sick. I went to the diner for breakfast and had some breakfast and a cup of coffee. And then I drove home, and they pulled me over because they said I forgot to use the turn signal or something. Anyhow, I didn't even think I was drunk, you know, and they said, well, we'll test you and see. Well, they took me up to the Girard Barracks, the Girard Township building in the middle of Girard there, where the police barracks was at. And they checked me, and I was just over the 0.10 it was at the time, you know. So that was an unfortunate incident that probably would never happen again, I was sure. So but I got fingerprinted, and they put me on ARD, if you know what that is. It's a probation for your first offense. That went okay. I went to the drunk driving school. I paid the probation fees and the fines, and I was allowed to walk, you know. But toward the end of the drunk driving school, they suggested that maybe you should go to AA, but it didn't say required. And no one told me at that time that that was 1989, by the way, that I was supposed mandated to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. If they did tell that to me, I didn't hear it. It just, you know. So in a short period of time, I started controlling my drinking again. Yeah. Oh, by the way, I was already married by this time. I got married in 1974, and my daughter was born in 77, and we built a house on in Lake City on Richardson Drive. I don't know if you know where Richardson Drive is, up North Girard Concord Road. I was on that road, and things went along pretty good at the beginning of the marriage. I was trying to control my drinking because we were married, because we had a baby on the way, and I did that pretty successfully for a while, you know. But like I said, after my daughter started getting a little older, I started bowling more, you know, more times a week. Sometimes three times a week I'd bowl. And the drinking started going hand in hand with the bowling. Although I didn't drink a lot while I was bowling, because I took my bowling pretty seriously, I usually drank. I went to the bar afterward and drank more. And in 1982, I went to the bar after bowling and started drinking shots with the guys, and I didn't normally do that. I have no idea why I did that. I was never a very good shot drinker, but I did it anyway. So anyhow, I stumbled out of the bar, and I went to drive home, and it was in the winter time. The truck didn't make it home, you know, like I thought it always would, you know. Even no matter how drunk I was, it was supposed to take me home like the cowboy on the horse, you know what I mean? That's what I kind of believe. But I must have passed out along the way. And I was only a mile and a half from my house, you know. Went off the road and I hit a cement culvert going under the road and broke the front wheel right off the truck. And so I left the truck there after I found out that it wasn't going anywhere. I left it there and walked the rest of the way home, you know. And I was drunk enough that I didn't want to tell my wife, didn't want to wake her up, so I just kind of like sneaked in and, you know, got into bed. About half an hour later, there was a knocking on my front door. I told the wife to get up and find out who it was. It was the local police, and he found my truck alongside of the road, hanging out half into the road, and suggested that we remove it or something. And I said, no, leave it there, I'll get it in the morning, you know. But he insisted, so I ended up riding back with him in the car. And going just that short distance out in the cold air, I started to wake up a little better, and I started to realize what was going on. And I said, holy crap, he can arrest me, can he? I better do something quick. So I told him to leave the truck there, and I ran away. That was the beginning of my running career. I started running. After that, I kept running, believe it or not. But anyhow, that particular night, I ran from the cop, and they chased me down through the woods and all over the place. I tried to go to my cousin's house in Lake City, and when they were down on this corner with their blinking lights, I was up here, you know. And then when they'd move down this way, I would go that way. And I was awake enough that I was able to stay out of their way. And my cousin didn't answer the door. So I ended up running from Lake City all the way down to where I live now on Fairplane Road, which is about 2.5 or 3 miles. And I wasn't an established runner then. Tried to go into the greenhouse where I worked part-time at Wogomoth Florist on Middle Road, and that was not warm enough. I was wet from here down, so running through the snow and stuff, you know. I started to get cold, shivering, so I went over to my dad's house. I didn't want to go to my dad's house, but I did. I banged on the door until he opened it up and let me in, and then I fell asleep on the couch. Apologized to him, of course, for waking him up, and I didn't hear anything more until the next day. You know, I called my wife about noon the next day and told her what had happened, and she said, they've been looking for you all night long. Where the hell were you? I said, I was hiding. Yeah. And they never did come back to find me or arrest me or anything for that. That was my first big run-in with the law, you know. I figured out later that because I was sober by the time all this happened, that they wouldn't have been able to do much anyway. So they just kind of just dropped it, and I never heard anything from it. So that just gave me the feeling that I'm able to get away with stuff, you know, if I drink and drive. And but like I said, in 1989, I got my first DUI after I was divorced from my wife already. I couldn't live with my wife because she couldn't live with my drinking. It didn't work. She wanted me to come home every night. I said, what? I don't know if I can do that. I was having too much fun drinking. I wasn't ready to quit yet. And so we ended up getting a divorce, and I moved out. And guess what happened another year later? Take a guess.
Got married.
Another DUI.
Well, this was my last DUI was in 1990 on Memorial Day weekend. Because of my problems with my drinking and my driving, and I was still on probation from my first arrest, I decided that I was not going to drive that night. I went to a keg party in Fairview. at the Parker White Metal Pavilion, if you know where that's at, behind Parker White. Another one of these deals where you pay a certain amount of money and they have the food and the booze and the dancing and everything. Horseshoes, volleyball, I loved it. I loved it. And I did that all day long. I went there at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and somewhere around midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning. And I know I didn't stop drinking that whole time. I drank the whole time. You know, I have no idea how I was even walking, let alone thinking about driving. And like I said, the plan was to stay there, sleep in the truck, and go home the next day, you know. Seems simple enough, but this alcoholic decided that, I have no idea why, I decided that I was going to go home then. And I tried to drive home. I went into a blackout just as I started driving. And when I woke up from my blackout, the red and blue lights were flashing in my rearview mirror. And I got my second DUI. In a two-year period, less than a two-year period, and I was arrested again. No accident, nothing happened. They just pulled me over. They said I was weaving this time, weaving. I know I was going around some potholes. I remember doing that, but I don't remember the weaving. That's what I tried to tell them too. I was going around the potholes. And when they stopped me and I got out of the truck, they wanted me to do the field sobriety test, you know, where you touch your nose and you walk the line. And I told him I can't do that. And he said, why not? And I said, I'm drunk. I'm drunk, arrest me. And I said that, literally. And he said, okay, we'll do that. And they took me up to the police barracks in the Girard State Police Barracks up on 18, and where I proceeded to throw up in the wastebasket, and they interrogated me for drunk driving number two. Well, by the way, they made me take the wastebasket container out to the dumpster by armed guard, too. And they said, we're not leaving that in here. You're taking that out right now, and we're following you out there. And I said, okay. It was pretty crazy, you know. So it was right at that time I admitted to myself, maybe it wasn't to God yet, but it was to myself, that I can't do this anymore. This is crazy. I don't want to do this anymore. Plus, I knew the rules that I was going to go to jail. And so what did happen was that my probation officer and my lawyer both told me in separate phone conversations that I was probably going to have to go to AA. So I said, okay, how do I do that? I became willing. So they directed me to the Dobbs Group, Thursday night, Pleasant Ridge Manor, when it was down in the other end of the building, where I walked in with the other Al K from Girard to my first meeting. And that was 4 days after I was 4 days without a drink when I went there for the first time. And they never told me when I should start. I just wanted to start right now, you know. And at the second week, I introduced myself as a visitor that first night. You know how they ask you, is there any visitors? I stood up, said, my name's Dan, and I think I said, I'm here to check this out, or something like that. I didn't know what I was supposed to do there. I didn't know anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I didn't know the Serenity Prayer. And I thought those bumper stickers that said "Easy Does It" were for senior citizen drivers, you know, some kind of club that they belong to. Something. I didn't know what it was. So I started going to one meeting a week, you know, until I got to see my probation officer again, and she said, "How many meetings a week are you going to?" And I said, "One." They said, go to one meeting more than you think you need. Do you follow that? So I went to one. I didn't think I needed any. So then I got signed up with GCAC and the drug and alcohol training, whatever you call it. I forgot what they called it. But anyhow, I did that for 20 weeks. So now I'm going to one meeting a week, and the probation officer in Girard once a week. And then she asked me, how many meetings a week you're going to? And I said, not counting this one, one. So I started going to a meeting in Girard on Saturday night. It was a lead meeting. They had it at the Presbyterian Church at the time. And so now I'm going to two meetings a week and the probation officer. And going to pee in the cup once a week, once a month or something. I can't remember how often that was. It wasn't very often. They started to trust me right away because I took one of those probation sheets that Al Kiefer had. I can use his name. I made copies of it, and I started filling out my own paperwork, you know, for AA mandatory attendance stuff, you know, before I had to. So when I started going into probation officer, I already had a whole pile of them like this, you know. Month, 2 months. By the third month, I probably was going to maybe four meetings a week. I just kept going, you know. I was living back with my dad's house again because it was centrally located between Fairview, Girard, and Lake City. And I started walking, I started riding my bike and running. I was doing all that stuff, and I was in pretty good shape there for a while, and then around that time, around the 1990s, the early 90s. And it was good for me, it really was. It got me out of my dad's house because he was still drinking. It got me to go to an AA meeting on Wednesday night in Fairview, where I, as Charlie knows, I used to walk there in the wintertime with my green boots on, and about two and a half mile walk, you know, one way and then back, you know. Because my dad had a poker night on Wednesday night, and he brought his friends in, and they drank and got crazy, and I didn't want to be there on Wednesday night anyway. So I got to be real regular at that Wednesday meeting in Fairview. And so anyhow, it proceeded really well. From then on, you know, I started to get more active. They started that meeting out in Springfield called, what was it called? Drop-in Center. The Drop-in Center out in Springfield, it was out there for a bunch of years, and I was going out there on Monday night because either Dan or Jim would pick me up and take me out there on Monday night, you know. My aunt and uncle used to take me to church on Saturday afternoon. I didn't really want to do that anymore, but I did, because they dropped me off at the Presbyterian Church where I could go to the AA meeting. So I was doing a lot of that stuff, you know. And I went in front of the judge in October of 1990, Dmitrievich, and naturally she wasn't real happy, you know. I tried to explain to her what happened, and she talked all over me, you know. Wouldn't allow me to explain. She didn't want to hear it, you know. But because I had a pretty decent lawyer, I got 7 days in jail is all. 2 years of probation, 2 years loss of driver's license. So that's for both of the DUIs at the same time. So all that time that I had no driver's license, I was paying people to give me a ride to work. I worked in a sheet metal manufacturing shop for 30 some years. And even after a period of time, they didn't even want to take my money. They didn't want to take me anymore. It got to be really tough in the second year getting rides to work, you know. But I did it, you know. I did it. Plus, went to the AA meetings, you know. So all that stuff, it started to be a part of my life. It was getting to be real comfortable, you know, it still is. You know, I quit drinking on May 28th, 1990 is my sobriety date. My sponsor is Nearly Normal Jim. His sponsor is Farmer Frank. I'm out there in Albion or someplace he lives, yeah. Anyhow, I took him as a sponsor in my second year because my first sponsor stopped going to meetings, believe it or not. And I said, well, and that was the only place I ever really talked well to him about was at the meetings. You know, I didn't pick up the phone and talk to him very much, you know, that first sponsor. I was always I'm going to see you on Tuesday, I'm going to see you on Saturday, you know. And that's the way I did it, you know. But when I got my new sponsor, Nearly Normal Jim, I started calling him because he worked a lot of hours, and I had to talk to him on the phone, or talk to him a lot of times, you know. But he was still going to that Tuesday men's group in Girard, too, and so we talked and saw each other at least once a week, you know. And I still have him for a sponsor today, you know. He's been very good for me. We used to go to bowling tournaments and out-of-town meetings and Niagara Falls and Derby, New York. We went to different places. Derby, New York is a men's conference, Christian conference for AA members. And it's still going on. They just moved its location to another location, but it's still going on. And so I just kept going to meetings. That's what I did. I went to work, went to meetings, you know. 1994, I was 4 years sober, I bought a house. Because I wasn't driving, because I didn't have any insurance, I was saving some money, you know. I ended up buying another house on Fairplane Road, which is two houses down from where I was born, the house I was born in. And it was not very expensive, but I offered the person, the owner, $5,000 less than what he asked. And I was, out of the first three people that bid on the job, I was the highest, believe it or not. So my house needed a lot of work. Over the years, I replaced all the windows and most of the doors. New garage door opener, garage door, and fixed up all the landscaping, built a deck in the back and in the front with the help of Mark Allgaier, and continued to hold my full-time job down at the same time, you know. And what happened in 2003, I lost my job at that sheet metal manufacturing place. They went out of business. They got bought out. And they got bought out by somebody in Minnesota or someplace, and I wasn't about to go to Minnesota. Because they went out of state, I was allowed to be retrained, and I went to Tri-State Business Institute, it's called Fortis now, and retrained my welding career. I'd been a welder for about the last 15 years of that employment there, and TIG welding and MIG welding mostly, and I learned some of the other types of welding while I was there, and I went every day, and not everybody that was going there went every day, and the reason why they went there, a lot of them, was just to keep their benefits going, their Social Security and stuff. And, but I didn't look at that way. I looked at it as a way of getting me another job, you know. And when they called me in and asked me what I wanted to do, I said, I want to work, you know. And they took that to heart and they gave me a job at General Electric, believe it or not. One of the few in our class of about 20 that got a job there. And in order to get that job, he had to call the lady in the office, you know, and ask her specifically, you know, to give me that job. Oh, how about that, you know? So I started working there in 2004 and retired there in 2010 when I became 63. So been around a while. And when I retired, I started getting busy with the Brown Baggers in Fairview. And I'm treasurer of the Brown Baggers. I meet 6 days a week at noon in Fairview, Presbyterian Church. And I know a lot of people here that are in this room today go there. I can see at least six have been there, 9, 10, 11, at least 11 in this room today that have been there. You know, it's a great place. It's a good meeting. We've made it better over the years, I think. It used to be in that little white church off to the side of, until they built the new auditorium that they have there, and they tore down the little white church, and now we're back in the basement of the old church, which is still okay because we got the whole room. We don't have to take the signs down and tables down every day when we're done, you know, and leave them up. And we buy food, snacks for people. And the most thing we do, I think, is we care. We care about people. We want them to get sober. And I hope I say something here today that'll help someone stay sober, you know. Even if it's only one person in this room, I'd have done my job, you know. My experience with the Brown Baggers and other meetings led me to a lot of things, you know. I go to the spring conference and every year, and been going to the anniversary dinner too. This is where you meet all the long timers in AA, you know, the people that have been around a long time, you know. And for me now, 27 years, it still doesn't seem like a long time. There's still a lot of people out there, a lot more than I got, you know. Some of them are in their 40s. We have one in Erie County that's over 50 years now, sobriety. Of course, I didn't get sober till I was 43, so I'll have to be 93 if I get 50 years. And what happened to me this year was makes me wonder whether I'm even going to make 75. In July this year, I was having some problems with some pain in my back here, and I knew it wasn't a pulled muscle because I know what pulled muscles feel like, you know. So I went to my doctor, my PCP, and he said, you got a bulge spot going there. And I told him, it hurts when you poke there. So he did some urine tests and some blood tests for me. Found out that I did not have a kidney infection like I thought I did. I told him, I think I have a kidney infection. He said, no, you don't. And you're not anemic. He took some more blood tests. You're not anemic. So he sent me to get a sonogram in Erie. And that's where they found out that I had a malignant tumor growing inside my abdominal cavity. And it was big. It was huge. And I said, no kidding. I didn't know that. That's the first time a doctor ever called me on the phone physically to talk to me. You know, usually they go through the office, you know, and blah, blah, blah. It didn't happen that way. He called me and told me that there's a problem and that we need to get another look at it. So they sent me for a CAT scan a few days later, and they found out that, yes, you have a really big tumor growing in there and it has to come out. So they, first of all, they signed me up with a surgeon in Erie, and when he looked at the CAT scan, he said, no, I can't do this. He didn't want to do it. It was too big. Not something he ever had to deal with before. So they recommended me to Pittsburgh, Shadyside Hospital in Pittsburgh. And I got to talk to Dr. Bart for the first time, on the phone first, and then made an appointment to go down and see him. That's the first time they showed me a picture of it on the computer screen. It didn't look very good. Scary. I agreed for the operation when I went down to see him. August 18th, this year, I went down there for my operation. And I went in there at 11 o'clock in the morning. They didn't start operating on me till somewhere around 2 in the afternoon. They had a lot of prep work to do. The operation lasted 5.5 hours. The tumor was 14 inches long. It was like the size of a small football it took out of me. And it encapsulated my right kidney. And they had to take a little piece of my liver out too. I spent 10 straight days, 3 days in ICU, and the other 7 days in a regular room down there, just trying to take regular nourishment, you know, 2 or 3 days on liquid diet, and then real light food, you know, like applesauce and Jell-O. And a couple days later, I finally got to have some mashed potatoes and gravy, you know. It was a haul. It was pretty traumatic for me. It hurt. So I was taking the pain medication they asked me to do, but by the time I left there, I stopped doing that. I started taking the regular over-the-counter medications, and on the 10th day, they said, well, what do you think? And I said, about what? They said, do you think you're ready to go home? And I said, ooh, I don't know, am I? I probably was not ready to go home, but I said yes. And I was very weak, tired, and I lost 22 pounds, but I went home anyway. And my brother-in-law and sister-in-law came down and get me. So since then, August 28th, I've been home, having my brother help me mow my lawn, and my sister come over and buy me food and things like that, you know, because I really wasn't moving around very much at all at the beginning. Just to walk out to my mailbox and get my mail was a job. I had trouble doing that. But I've been getting stronger since then. It's 2 months now, a little over 2 months. And I feel wonderful now. And whether it's going to reoccur again or not, I don't know. I have to go back in December for another CAT scan, and they'll be able to tell from there whether I'm moving forward or not, you know. But right now, I'm living life. I am. This is good. Life is good today. The weather was nice today. I mean, I'm driving again today. I haven't been arrested in 27 years. Not that it can't happen, like for speeding or yellow lights. I have a problem with yellow lights. They always come on just as I'm getting to the car. But some of them things turn from yellow to red a lot faster. I don't know if you've noticed that. I have. Some of them stay yellow longer than other ones do before they turn red. Time it if you don't believe me. I'm scared that one of these days it's going to turn red before I go under it and they're going to catch me, you know. But that's, to me now, that's nothing. That's very trivial stuff to me today, you know. So I'm still in the process of paying co-payments, you know, for the operation. And I still haven't got a bill from the doctor yet, you know. That one scares me a little. He went on vacation right after he got done with my operation. But I wanted to talk to him after I, you know, while I was still in the hospital, and they just sent me his second man, you know, Dr. Boone. And I asked him finally one day, I said, well, where's Dr. Bartlett at? And he said, oh, he went on vacation. So it pays well doing what he does, you know. But he specializes in cancer treatment and oncology down there at so I got one of the best, I found out. One of the best in Pittsburgh. So I'm very confident that they told me they got all of it. Now, I don't know if that's, cancer scares me, you know. How many people do you know that had cancer and then they thought they were cured and then it comes back again, and it's scary, you know. So I live with that every day now, you know, but I want to live every day. As much as I can, you know, and I hope I make it to that 93. I want to be 50 years sober. That's a ways to go yet, if God willing, you know. I really believe in a higher power. I believe in I call him the unseen spirit. I mean, I don't believe in a higher power that's an old man in the sky, or I hate to say this, a young man with long brown hair and blue eyes. That's not what I believe in. It's completely spiritual. There's no form, no face, no nothing. It's just a feeling. It's a fact that if you believe in something other than yourself, you can stay sober. And I believe. I do. Thank you for my sobriety.